Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll remember the life of Ken Sarawiwa, the Nigerian writer and activist hanged for speaking out against environmental and human rights crimes. And we'll find out how and why he died and hear some of his writings. Then we'll explore the world of greenwashing. Many corporations spend millions of dollars to portray themselves as environmentally friendly, but oftentimes they are just empty claims. And in our Earth calendar, we'll explore the world of glades. These seemingly barren lands are actually filled with dynamic plants and animals, which are now making rubbery, scummy mats. This should tantalize your imagination. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. On November 10, 1995, Ken Sarawiwa was executed by hanging in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. I learned about Mr. Sarawiwa last year when he was awarded the Goldman Prize, an honor that is bestowed by the Goldman Environmental Foundation of San Francisco to the outstanding individual from each continent who has done the most to protect the environment. Dwayne Silverstein, executive director of the foundation, describes Ken Sarawiwa's crusade.
Royal Dutch Shell struck oil on the Ogoni lands in 1958 and, according to a Wall Street Journal article, has extracted some $30 billion, that's billion with a B, worth of oil since then. Yet even by Africa's standards, the Ogoni people remain desperately poor, and the Wall Street Journal article went to say that have been left with a ravaged environment as well. Ken Sarawiwa, who is a very noted, prominent author in Nigeria, has become the lead spokesman on behalf of the Ogoni people, on behalf of the environment there, and he's done it with a lot of courage, and he's paid a very, very serious price for speaking out.
At one point, Sarawiwa organized a protest against the oil companies, which included 300,000 of the 500,000 Ogonis. He was arrested numerous times and ultimately charged with having responsibility for the death of four people who were killed during a demonstration he was not at. His imprisonment and trial was closely watched by international human rights organizations. Kurt Goering is deputy director of the U.S. branch of Amnesty International.
This is the latest indication of the Nigerian military's utter contempt for the most basic international human rights standards. I actually cannot recall another recent incident in which a government has spurned the pleas from around the world to spare the life of someone who is clearly an environmental and human rights activist, against whom the charges of complicity in murder are quite weak, and who was subjected to a trial which lacked the most elemental standards of due process. And despite those serious problems, despite the widespread pleas for clemency, the Nigerian military just snubbed its nose at the world community and went forward with the executions.
Barika Idamkwe, who is a director of the organization Sarawiwa founded, describes his imprisonment and trial.
Ken was not tried in the normal Nigerian court. He was detained for 8 months without charge, without access to his lawyer or his family or medical attention. He was starved. He was chained for 65 days, chained to his cell for 65 days. He was not charged. He did not see any lawyer. Nobody saw him. He was held incommunicado. And so they thought of what to do, and because there was no evidence for them to try him in the normal court, they had to set up a special military tribunal, and they bribed witnesses, bribed people to bear false witnesses against him.
They also charged that by inviting Nigerian troops to Ogoni lands to protect oil installations, Shell was responsible for the incredible oppression the Nigerian army inflicted on Ogoni people. The Environment Show repeatedly tried to contact a spokesman for the Nigerian government and from Shell, without success. But Shell did forward a statement from Brian Anderson, managing director of Shell in Nigeria. Shell denies all allegations of bribery made during the proceedings which resulted in the conviction of Sarawiwa, and Shell does not accept that oil activities have caused devastation in Ogoni land or anywhere in their area of operations in the Niger Delta. Goering of Amnesty International disagrees.
The undeniable point that they can't escape from or remove themselves from is that they carry a great deal of responsibility for the air, the soil, and the water pollution that has devastated that land.
International response has been strong. Steps taken by the Clinton administration are described by Mac DeShazer of the National Security Council in the White House.
We have also decided to ban the sale and repair of military goods and services to Nigeria.
In addition, the U.S. ambassador to Lagos has been called home, and the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has been instructed to explore further international sanctions. So far, governmental authorities have been cool to the demand of a number of private groups to establish an international embargo of Nigerian oil. Ken Saro-Wiwa well understood the plight of his Ogoni people resulted from forces that were not confined to Nigeria. Ken Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch, reads from one of Saro-Wiwa's writings in which he reflects about the role of world oil markets.
What has happened and what is happening to the Ogoni is strictly not the fault of the Nigerian elite and Shell Company alone. The international community has played a very significant role in it. If the Americans did not purchase Nigerian oil, the Nigerian nation would not be, nor would the oppressive ethnic majority in the country have the wherewithal to pursue its genocidal intentions. Indeed, there is a sense in which the Nigerian oil, which the Americans, Europeans, and Japanese buy, is stolen property. It has been seized from its owners by force of arms and has not been paid for. Therefore, these buyers are receiving stolen property. Also, it is Western investment and technology which keep the Nigerian oil industry and therefore the Nigerian nation alive, oil being 94% of Nigeria's gross domestic product. Also, European and American shareholders and multinational oil companies and manufacturers of oil mining equipment have benefited from the purloining of Ogoni resources, the devastation of the Ogoni environment, and the genocide of the Ogoni people.
We conclude with Roth's reading of Saro-Wiwa's poem of spiritual exhaustion called Tusaroga, which means rainmaker.
We have returned with empty hands and hollow minds from the thunderstorm, raining blood, O mighty one, whose wink brings rain. We did not pray for war. Wash the stain of strife away. We'll speak no more of coups and colonels and raids at dead of night. We'll forget the bombs, build scores of tombs, and bury the dead. Receive us, mighty one, with a cleansing shower.
We honor Ken Saro-Wiwa, who gave his life fighting for the freedom of his people and the health of their land. I'm Peter Burley. We've all seen ads touting the environmental sensitivity of chemical, oil, and timber companies. These ads are part of the broader world of public relations. Last year, the top 15 PR firms collectively took in $1 billion. Some environmentalists say wealthy corporations mount so-called greenwashing campaigns to divert attention from their environmental shortcomings. But the PR companies say they're only employing the same tactics of many environmental groups. Thomas Lally reports on the battle for public opinion.
Dow lets you do great things. Beef, real food for real people. Without chemicals, life as we know it wouldn't exist. GE, we bring good things to life. All of these slogans serve as cornerstones for advertising and public relations campaigns. While these kinds of campaigns are nothing new, the widespread use of environmental awareness as a selling point is. But can we believe what they say, and how pervasive is their influence?
It's completely pervasive and very ubiquitous. Every time you watch television news or read an article in the paper, you're being influenced by a public relations campaign.
John Stauber is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and co-author of the book Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies, and the Public Relations Industry. He says while all industries today employ similar PR strategies, greenwashing is today particularly popular. But PR is a lot more than just advertising. PR firms also lobby politicians who then go on to write legislation. They also vie for the attention of journalists who go on to write the news. However it's done, PR campaigns are often successful.
some major polluting corporations have had tremendous greenwashing success. Companies such as Dow Chemical, through spending millions of dollars on greenwashing public relations campaigns, have, according to opinion polls, really changed their ranking with the public, and their work has, I believe, misled many people into thinking that they have a renewed environmental responsibility, when what they really have is an invigorated environmental public relations campaign that's changed their public image.
One of the ways Stauber says these so-called greenwashing campaigns work is by giving print journalists pre-written stories. PR firms also provide video and audio material, including fully produced stories, to the electronic media. So some of the news you hear and see is a product not of a journalist, but of someone paid by a PR firm. But those in the PR industry say there's nothing wrong with this. John Polusek is the president of Ketchum Public Affairs, the world's seventh largest PR firm.
If I were a news director at a radio or television station, I would take great umbrage and be rather angry with Mr. Stauber, because what he is saying is, in effect, an insult to their intelligence, and that it always becomes a matter of the editor as to whether to use it and how to identify it.
Polusek's firm specializes in what's called crisis management, or damage control. This is the process of minimizing negative publicity when an event like the Exxon Valdez oil spill takes place, which jeopardizes an organization's reputation. While many people, like Stauber, question how a PR firm could represent, for instance, a tobacco company to help them advertise their message that tobacco has no link to cancer, Polusek says PR firms provide an important and necessary service.
I have no problem in representing a chemical company, a nuclear company, any number of other companies that Stauber attacks. What he fails to appropriately weigh is the fact that these companies and these industries provide a very valuable service to society, that our entire civilization and society is largely based on how we handle chemicals and how we handle energy, and responsible work in that area is to be represented with honor.
But PR is not just for chemical and tobacco companies. Virtually all organizations, from your neighborhood church to Fortune 500 companies, use PR methods to cast themselves in the best light. While corporate interests represent the overwhelming majority of public relations, nonprofits are also getting into the act. Environmental Media Services is a nonprofit PR firm representing environmental groups. Arlie Schart is the executive director. He says being viewed as environmentally friendly is today crucial to any organization's public image.
See that in every time you turn on the television or open a magazine and see these huge spreads of, for example, the timber companies publish these gorgeous two-page full-color spreads in all the big national magazines where a father and son are looking out over a beautiful forest, and the father is telling his son how proud he is that his company is helping to preserve and protect and regenerate forests for future generations and so on. It's clearly something that is that corporations feel is an extremely important part of their public image.
John Stauber says issues today are not just lobbied, but managed. This means that a disaster like Union Carbide's accident in Bhopal, India, is mitigated on all levels, from community outreach to advertising to press conferences and finally to lobbying. He encourages people to pay attention not only to what is being said, but who is saying it, and finally to take everything with a very large grain of green salt. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're entering the holiday season, a time when Americans consume more in just a few weeks than some people in third world countries consume in a lifetime. Are there enough resources to let us do this forever? Probably not. So how can we achieve a sustainable Christmas or Hanukkah? Some suggest using less wrapping materials and avoiding styrofoam. Others advocate organic foods. We want your suggestions about how each of us can achieve a sustainable holiday, and we will broadcast them on a later show. Write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 1-800-282-1206. Or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, in our Ear to the Ground segment, you'll meet the woman who led the fight to return wolves to Yellowstone National Park. Then a Wyoming rancher will lock horns with an environmentalist over whether we should continue to release wolves in the West. And our Earth calendar will explore the dynamic world of glades. These seemingly barren areas are now making the transition from a hot, dry summer to the wet winter by creating rubbery, scummy mats. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Renee Askins, returning wolves to the wild. For thousands of years, the wolf roamed freely throughout our continent. Perceived as a threat to livestock by settlers in the West, wolves were systematically slaughtered. By the 1930s, the wolf was exterminated in the West, including in the nation's first national park, Yellowstone, an area protected to preserve wildlife and natural wonders. Wolves now have been returned to Idaho, and more symbolically, last March in Yellowstone. Largely responsible was Renee Askins, founder and executive director of the Wolf Fund. Personally passionate about wolves, Askins, a Yale-educated biologist, recognized Yellowstone as the perfect place to restore wolves to the wild.
I really think that it's an extraordinary place. It's the largest temperate ecosystem, certainly in the lower 48, and it's an international biosphere reserve, and it offers a sizable wilderness that really there nowhere else in the lower 48 offers any longer. It's really one of the few places that can support free-ranging predators like bears and mountain lions and wolves. And so it was very important ecologically, but it was also very important ethically that this was our first national park.
Askins' role with the Wolf Fund has been that of educator and advocate. For 14 years, she has tirelessly devoted herself to this cause, never believing that it wouldn't happen. She traveled and talked to everyone, from environmentalists, politicians, celebrities, and ranchers. Askins says so many issues are framed as us against them, and she felt it was important to build bridges rather than dig trenches, which meant working with ranchers. To many ranchers, Askins says the reintroduction of wolves represented a threat that was bigger than the wolf itself. It meant giving up control and accepting the social change in the West. The wolf issue she sees as a vehicle for opening dialogue on many of these difficult issues. With the wolves back in Yellowstone, there is now one complete ecosystem, same as it was before Europeans entered this continent.
The distinct action of actually seeing the wolves come into the park and then, of course, you know, 3 months later seeing them released was just a tremendous delight. And beyond our wildest dreams, having somewhere between, you know, the reports are up to 10 to 15,000 people actually see the wolves, you know, throughout the summer was just so wonderful. We never, ever thought that the wolves would be as visible in these early stages. So that was just really, you know, a great reward, I think, for the public that had really worked so hard to make this happen.
With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. The introduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park has raised the ire of many ranchers who say their livestock is put in danger by these predators. But environmentalists say wolves are an important part of the ecosystem and rarely attack cows or sheep. Joining us are Roger Schlickhausen, president of the Defenders of Wildlife, a national environmental group, and Larry Burette, vice president of the Farm Bureau in Cheyenne, Wyoming, locking horns over the question, should the introduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park continue? Mr. Schlickhausen?
Well, the answer is yes. First, an overwhelming majority of Americans strongly support wolf reintroduction to Yellowstone. The law requires that the wolf be returned, and scientists say it will be good for the ecosystem's health. Not only that, it should produce about $20 million in annual tourist revenue to the region. Meanwhile, the cost of wolf predation on livestock, and there may be no net increase because of the displacement of coyotes by wolves, will be minimal. And even that minimal amount will be fully reimbursed by Defenders of Wildlife, which pays ranchers at market value for any losses. The rational arguments are all on the side of returning the wolf to Yellowstone. There is no reason to delay moving forward with the second round of reintroductions this winter.
And Mr. Barrett, in reply.
We do not feel it should continue. In fact, we'd like to have the wolves that are there now returned to Canada because they're not essential. In fact, it's a non-essential experimental population. They're not endangered. There are 60,000 of them in Canada, 2,000 in Minnesota, and 5,000 in Alaska. They're not biologically endangered. Therefore, this is a waste of time and scarce resources. And in fact, this is so non-essential that we checked this morning and the Yellowstone National Park wolf biologist isn't working today.
Mr. Schlickhausen, in response.
Well, Larry's arguments are nonsense, and they've been shown to be such over and over again. The lawsuit they're bringing is a nuisance lawsuit brought only for political reasons, and it has no chance of prevailing in court. I'll make one final point. The symbolic importance of restoring the wolf to Yellowstone makes the event one of the real watersheds in conservation. Like it or not, living nature is now hostage to human attitudes, and maybe by agreeing to save the wolf, we can begin to improve society's attitude toward nature and other species of life.
Mr. Barrett, the last word.
Well, when we talk about reality, the government is shut down today because of a shortage of money. We're spending money in this case on a vision that some people have, but it's not an essential vision. It does not take into consideration all of the problems that this nation has in many other arenas. It is just, we'd like to have it, and that's just what it is.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Glades are common in many parts of the Southeast and Midwest. They're also known as barrens, since the soil is thin and only grasses and some small trees can grow there. But these places display a rich variety of life. As many as 250 species of wildflowers can grow in a single glade. During the summer months, glades get hot and dry, boasting life commonly found in the desert. But this time of year, glades begin to change. Plants that were once subject to searing heat are now covered with snow and standing water. George Yaskevich is a botanist with the Missouri Department of Conservation and curator of plants at the Missouri Botanical Gardens.
Many of the most interesting creatures that live on glades are things that one might think of more from the southwestern United States, have extensions of their ranges into these glade systems. For example, in Missouri, in our glades, is where one finds scorpions and tarantulas. So in some ways it's sort of a prairie-like environment because it has lots of grasses, the difference being that there's not as much soil. Well, one of the really fascinating things about glades for nature study is that there's a real seasonality and that there is a changing of what is active and interesting. During the spring and late spring months, we have really nice wildflower blooms on some of these glades, which is when things are starting to dry up, but not so dry that everything has become crisp. As we move into the drier summer months, a lot of things tend to go dormant. Then in the fall, after they start shedding their fruits, a lot of things are shutting down on the glades. And as we move into winter, actually it's the lichens and some of the algae and some of the blue-green bacteria that really come into their own because they're able to deal with these wetter conditions, and that's really a good time of year for them. And they're dormant then during the hotter, drier parts of the year.
Dr. Yaskevich says that right about now, the blue-green bacteria, formerly known as blue-green algae, are forming rubbery, scummy mats on the glades. Could it be that some of these bacteria have reached Washington, and that's what really shut down the government? Thanks for joining us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 307. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long. Join us next week for The Environment Show.